Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Friday, February 22nd, 2019. President Kiir is expected to visit his home state to promote peace deal, but some analysts say that is not where he should go.
Might have been a good idea if the President Kiir, after celebrating peace with Riek Machar on 30th of November last year, all of them were supposed to go across all other states.
And food insecurity is on the rise for millions of South Sudanese.
Food scarcity at household level has led to severe asset depletion as people try to raise income to purchase food. Even as they do this, the ongoing economic crisis has significantly reduced their purchasing power.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. President Kiir is expected to tour the northern Bahr al-Ghazal area and Terkeka state next week. A minister in the office of the president says Kiir hopes to drum up support for the implementation of the revitalized peace deal. A Juba-based analyst say rather than visiting his state, the president should visit areas that were hardest hit by the four-year conflict. Onan Walter Solomon reports for VOA from Juba.
Minister Maik Ayi says the president will ask South Sudanese to support efforts by the warring parties to implement the peace deal.
His commitment to this peace agreement is irreversible. The president will therefore assure the citizens along the way that peace has returned to the country and that war has officially ended. He will therefore ask citizens to embrace peace among themselves.
Ayi says President Kiir greatly values the views of ordinary South Sudanese and will listen to what they have to say.
The president wants first-hand experience about road infrastructure, which is vital for the economy. The president will assure the people of South Sudan that the government pursues peace because it plans to revive the economy and invest in critical transport and communication infrastructure. The president will largely hold rallies in state capitals and large population.
The minister also says Mr. Kiir will use the tour to learn the needs and expectations of citizens.
The president greatly values ordinary people's views, and so he will be keen to listen to the people and to have the first-hand information of their living condition.
The minister says Kiir will encourage citizens to participate in the ongoing national dialogue on the peace deal and listen to their recommendations on how to end all forms of communal violence. Abraham Kolnyot, a political analyst and professor at the University of Juba, says Kiir's tour, which he calls long overdue, should have included stops in the hardest hit areas of the conflict.
There are three major hotspots. One hotspot is the Unity State, especially in Bintiu. He's supposed to go to Malakal in Upper Nile, and then he's supposed to go thirdly to Yambio.
And Cole says Kiir should have toured the country with his former deputy Riek Machar months ago, shortly after the revitalized peace agreement was signed in September.
It might have been a good idea if the President Kiir, after celebrating peace with Riek Machar on 30th of November last year, all of them were supposed to go across all other states. But if not possible, Kiir is supposed to arrange for his own visit, and Riek is supposed to arrange for his own visit.
Cole says it's all about creating confidence among the people of South Sudan. The president's tour will begin in Terkeka on Tuesday and wind up in Lol State. Kiir is expected to address rallies in state capitals and large population centers. Presidential spokesman Atenue Katen says Kiir will also tour the Upper Nile and Equatorial regions, but did not say when. For VOA News, I am Onan Walter Solomon in Juba.
Nearly 7 million people in South Sudan could face acute food insecurity at the height of the of May to June lean seasons, according to three United Nations agencies and the government. The UN Food and Agriculture Organization, UNICEF, and the World Food Programme, together with the government, released the latest Integrated Food Security Phase Classification report today. It shows the number of people who are acutely insecure has increased by 13% since January 2018. Winnie Chirino has more for VOA from Juba.
In announcing the results of the IPC analysis, Isaiah Chol Arai, chairman of the National Bureau of Statistics, said the conflict continues to disrupt food production, deplete livestock, and negatively impact people's access to alternative food sources like fish, livestock, and wild foods.
Food scarcity at household level has led to severe asset depletion as people try to raise income to purchase food. Even as they do this, the ongoing economic crisis has significantly reduced their purchasing power, particularly the most vulnerable populations who rely on purchasing highly priced foods from market.
The report says some 30,000 people in Jonglei and Lake States are already experiencing extreme food insecurity, which is called the Catastrophe Phase or IPC5, the highest level of food insecurity. The report shows that food insecurity continues to be driven by the cumulative effects of conflict, including population displacement. Other factors include the macroeconomic crisis, climate shocks such as prolonged dry spells and flooding, and pest infestation. As a result, according to the report, cereal production this year will only meet slightly over half of the country's cereal needs, compared to 61% in 2018. Simon Kamel Beek, the WFP's acting country director in South Sudan, says the WFP plans to pre-position 175,000 tons of food in more than 60 warehouses ahead of the rainy season to reduce delivery costs. Kamel Beek says for the first time in 5 years, WFP is using rivers and some roads to move relief items to villages in Jonglei and Unity States.
To meet the increased needs, WFP will provide the most vulnerable people with a variety of support, including life-saving food and cash contribution distributions where markets are working. In return for food and the construction and rehabilitation of community assets, food for school meals, and special products for the prevention and treatment of malnutrition among children and pregnant and nursing women.
Kamel Beek says the humanitarian situation will worsen as more refugees and IDPs return to their homes. Pierre Vauthier, representative of the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization in South Sudan, says her agency will provide seeds and fishing equipment to help returnees regain their sources of livelihood.
For us, it would be passing by giving the means of the farmers, the fishermen, the livestock keepers to produce their own food to generate their own markets. The future of South Sudan will pass by the generation of a very wealthy market of food, food in the country, addressing the demand of the national consumption.
Andrea Chalet, the UNICEF country representative for South Sudan, says the signing of the revitalized peace deal has given her agency a chance to reach out to more children than what was possible during the height of the fighting. But children in particular are suffering.
UNICEF and partners expect some 860,000 children across South Sudan to be acutely malnourished in 2019. That is almost twice the number of people living in Juba, to give you a sense of the number. 30% of these children will be severely acute malnourished with a high risk of dying.
Andrea Noyes, deputy head of the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs in South Sudan, says required paperwork and bureaucratic impediments usually delay emergency support to those in need.
To prevent more people from slipping into catastrophic conditions, humanitarian organizations need predictable and consistent access across the country. The revitalized peace agreement offers us hope of improved access conditions, but there are still parts of the country where insecurity prevents aid groups from delivering life-saving services to communities in need, for example, around Yei.
But Noyes says there are still parts of the country where insecurity prevents AIDS groups from delivering food and other life-saving services in places like Yei. For VOA News, I am Winnie Serino in Juba.
From Juba, we move to Nigeria, where the winners in Nigeria's general election on Saturday will face a disturbing challenge. of how to help millions of children in the country suffering from malnutrition. While hunger is gradually declining in Nigeria, the rate of acute malnutrition is on the rise. Timothy Obiazu reports from Abuja.
40-year-old Simaila Shingiri and his wife's 2-year-old triplets are among millions of Nigerian children suffering from malnutrition. Shingiri says they could not afford to feed them properly as babies and can't afford it now. We are begging the government to help us because we don't have money to even buy food. We are begging the government, he says. According to the United Nations Children's Fund, child hunger in Nigeria is declining by about 3% per year. But the rate of severe acute malnutrition, the technical term for starvation, remains unchanged. The UN Children's Agency says 2.5 million Nigerian children are starving and only about 20% of that figure get help. Nigeria's health ministry distributes food and treatment, but Clementina Okoro, a nutrition expert with the ministry, admits it's not enough.
It's really a serious issue of public health concern. Malnutrition has been on the rise. Yes, over 900,000 children die annually.
Widespread poverty, insecurity in the north, and poor health care are major triggers for child malnutrition in Nigeria. Exclusive breastfeeding gives children a better start in life, but not enough mothers practice it, says pediatrician Adeyemi Adeniran.
From the point of birth, the baby is being introduced to breastfeeding, and that is the cheapest and the best. But the advocacy and the awareness about this has been a bit poor. We're also bringing that on board now to encourage mothers to make sure they breastfeed exclusively for 6 months.
But better health care only goes so far in alleviating widespread poverty. Nigerians are going to the polls on Saturday, and whoever emerges president faces the challenge of improving the economy so more Nigerian children can live long and healthy lives. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, revenue collection has become much easier in South Sudan. Find out how that happened when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what makes you laugh?
When I have freedom in my life, I can laugh.
These are funny things that normally a human being does, an animal does, anything that is funny.
What makes me laugh is something that makes me happy. Fun, comedy, anything that is funny makes me laugh.
It's according to the person you're talking with, it's according to the mood you wake up with. You can even laugh at something when it's very simple.
When someone crack a joke, when I see something funny, yeah. That makes me laugh.
The times you went through with others, friends, or something like that. Okay, anything good that has ever happened to you in your life.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. The head of South Sudan's National Revenue Authority says his agency collected 1.2 billion South Sudanese pounds and more than $4 million in non-oil revenues in January alone. That is the highest amount of money the body has ever collected in 1 month. The head of the National Revenue Authority, who is a Ghanaian by nationality, says he is enforcing reforms to ensure corrupt South Sudanese tax officials can no longer steal money. Dimo Silva Aurelio has details for VOA from Juba.
In the past, South Sudan's tax collection system was disorganized and unregulated. In 2016, the government enacted the National Revenue Authority Bill, which established the South Sudan Revenue Authority, an independent body that collects, manages, and supervises all non-oil revenue that comes in across the country. The government hired Ghanaian Olympio Atipo in March last year as Commissioner General for the South Sudan National Revenue Authority. Atipo says he established a single national revenue block account in December, and collection has vastly improved since then.
As at 31st January
2019, we managed successfully to account for £1.28 billion. The pounds here, we've collected £1.28 billion. And then we also managed to collect $4,600,000.
Atipo says he is working to enforce tough reforms to ensure the government receives much-needed non-oil revenues.
We are introducing what we call cashless transaction. We don't want any officers to receive cash. We want taxpayers to just get the assessment form, go to bank and deposit money into the National Revenue Authority account.
Atipo says as part of the reforms, the National Revenue Authority will have to let go of some individuals and recruit others. He says the institution will contract with an international consultant to ensure qualified people collect public funds.
Pulling the resources together means that we are going to close people's pockets. We are going to stop people's livelihood. You know, it's not it's illegal livelihood. And you don't expect people to keep quiet. You don't expect people to see them.
Atipo says the National Revenue Authority will collect taxes from employees in both public and private sectors.
Effective January this year, they will begin to pay their personal income tax, which is a huge thousands of dollars that we have been missing monthly from all this year.
There are thousands of people working for local and international non-governmental organizations in South Sudan. In the past, the government did not collect personal income tax from these employees. Atipo says the National Revenue Authority will also streamline tax exemptions given to UN agencies like ANMIS, but some exemptions will be waived. One Juba resident who did not want to be identified by name for fear of reprisals from the government welcomes the new transparency of the National Revenue Authority, but says he doubts the money collected will be used to benefit taxpayers.
How this revenue that is being clearly indicated to us going to reach the people on the ground? Because it is money and we don't know how that money is going to be used.
Atipo says centralized revenue collection will enable the government to fund national projects. He says the process will soon be expanded to all states to ensure that all collections are recorded into a unified database. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
The renewed fighting in Yei River State between the government and rebels of the National Salvation Front raises questions about the government's priorities in South Sudan amid humanitarian uncertainties across the country. That's according to at least one South Sudan expert. Clem Ryan, a senior advisor at the European Institute of Peace in Brussels, says there is progress on the implementation of the peace deal, but it's not without challenges.
There is an ongoing dialogue about issues such as cantonment of forces and boundary commissions and so on and so forth. And just in the last week, there was actually a budget released for the implementation for the next 4 months, estimating about a requirement for about $285 million to fund the various elements of the agreement. In parallel with that, we're also seeing military offensives or an offensive in Yei that's been prepared for quite some time and is ongoing. It's difficult to get a clear sense of exactly what is happening, but we're seeing displacement. We have consistent reports of involvement of Ugandan forces, and we have seen that the verification and monitoring teams have had difficulty accessing many of the key areas. We're also seeing reports, reporting from some of the UN entities on activities from late last year. There was the issue around the mass sexual assaults in Bentiu. The report came out last week on that established very clearly that there had been a very serious incident there. And we're also seeing reports about increased food insecurity just in the last few days.
And not to mention what's going on in Yei, how does the renewed fighting, as I saw it written, how does that impact the entire peace agreement moving forward?
The fighting is largely directed at NAS, the National Salvation Front, led by Thomas Cirillo, conducted by the government and its affiliates. NAS is a signatory to the cessation of hostilities agreement, but they're not actually a party to the revitalized agreement. So given that they sit outside of that, the government has used that as the pretext for conducting these operations and alleging that NAS is acting as a spoiler, essentially, to the implementation of the agreement. But in a broader sense, it does cast doubts about the sincerity of the government, I think, in many regards, you know, about what the priorities are, why they feel it's absolutely necessary to go and conduct these operations when at the same time they're facing all these other challenges that I just mentioned about the humanitarian situation, about trying to fund a peace agreement. You know, is this really consistent with a broader idea that there is actually peace in South Sudan? And that's the question that we're assessing at the moment.
And funding, I understand, is a really big issue. Where are the Western donors in this conversation about funding South Sudan's peace agreement?
Western donors are remaining engaged, and they've consistently signaled that they wish to support the implementation of the agreement. Everybody acknowledges that peace is essential and wants to help that happen, but there are ongoing concerns. The US government has been very reticent about repeating some of what it perceives as mistakes from the past of just providing money for institutions and for processes that have not moved forward. Other significant donors are trying to find incremental ways of supporting on the fringes, but there's still quite a bit of doubt about the actual oversight, the proper use of these funds, and whether they will actually contribute to a sustainable peace in South Sudan. This is offset also against doubts about the transparency about how South Sudan is actually dealing with its own revenues. There is, no one really quite knows where all of the oil revenue is going at the moment and why the government has such difficulty funding its own projects. So there are a lot of questions that haven't as yet been satisfactorily answered. So the donors are by and large holding off and just waiting and seeing. And then that is obviously creating issues. The government is using this raising this concern as a reason for why implementation is not going forward.
And, this really does feel like a pivotal moment for South Sudan. I mean, a lot has gone into making sure this peace works.
Yeah, I agree. I was meeting with, I've met with a number of diplomatic figures just in the last few days, and they expressed exasperation and fatigue over the issue. This, we've had more than 5 years of civil war in South Sudan, and it feels that some people are talking about a last chance, whatever that would mean in this context, it's not clear. But there is a very clear sense of exasperation and an exhaustion that we seem to repeating the same issues, the same people. We're hoping that we want to move forward from this, but as of yet, the signs are unclear, I would say, at best.
That was Clive Ryan, Senior Advisor for the Brussels-based European Institute of Peace, speaking to Ayen Dengbior via WhatsApp from Addis Ababa this past hour. The former commissioner of Morobo County in Yei River State is denying allegations that he is involved in illegal mining activities in South Sudan. Moses Simon Soro says there is chaos in the mining industry in South Sudan, and the country has good laws for regulating mining, but some corrupt officials in the government ignore these laws and deplete the country's resources. Soro says he has not been involved in any exploration of natural resources in South Sudan.
It's just a baseless allegation in a document which circulated on WhatsApp and Facebook. The title is President Kiir and his vice, Wani Iga, gold mining saga in Greater Equatorial. This document purports that I am one of the beneficiaries of the gold mining corruption that they purport to be exposing in South Sudan. I found that very defaming to my character. It's a false statement, which is meant to equate me to the acts of corruption, especially in the mining sector, which I found completely unfounded and untrue.
Since you're saying that it's not true, why would you bother with something that you don't believe it is true?
My name appeared in it, and our people back home these days, they are these negative information peddlers who like just to stir trouble within the country. The country is going through a lot of problems. And we could really be good to guard ourselves and focus on the main important things that will make us really move our country forward than trying to pick and choose what really can entice people into believing that this is something true, which is completely not true.
You were once the county commissioner for Yei when it was Central Equatoria, is that correct?
I was, county commissioner for Morobo County when it was Central Equatoria, that's correct.
Talk to us a little bit about the politics of natural resources in the area, because there are lots of reports coming there that the forest is being depleted. Everybody's getting into the forest and they can cut trees and take them to Uganda. Tell us what you know about what was happening there.
What I know is the same thing like in mining. The Minister of Agriculture is responsible for the forests in those locations. And also there's a state law which says the state is also responsible. So there's a mix up who is responsible. You find some licenses for exploiting the forests coming from the Minister of Agriculture in the national government. And some licenses are also issued by the state government. So these two all scramble into the forest, especially Loka and Kejiko, and even Kegulu. Some individuals also entered into it. And that, of course, definitely opened up the space for people to abuse the system that was supposed to be followed to make sure that these forests are harvested properly. And, of course, the way you cut, then you have to reafforestate. But completely, these things are all in paper. Today, these forests are all not there because of this irresponsible way of issuing licenses. And even the money going, you don't know where the money goes.
Are there any mining reserves in Yei River State?
They are there, but of course, at the moment, this is still the explorational stage. What I know, and as well as a commissioner, in Odabi, there's prospects of gold. Lobonog, there's gold. Let's say around Juba, there's definitely the minerals, gold and all this. Wunduruba, the same, gold. But there's a proper system that is in place in South Sudan that our people do not understand. First of all, there's what we call the South Sudan Mining Act, which came out in 2012. This one stipulates clearly exactly how these things are supposed to be done. And even this, in 2015, they came out with the mining regulations, which, of course, if the people making such allegations are really wise to do that, they should do a bit of research to find out exactly what it says, the Mining Act and the mining regulations.
Yeah, but there are lots of laws in South Sudan that are good on paper, but the challenge is in implementing them. You know, there are several laws that nobody seems to be caring about them. So what is so special about the Mining Act that you want people to look at it carefully?
Yeah, because what this act has done is it has opened up the space for competition and, of course, to bring in, first of all, the most important thing that it brought in what is called like improvement in transparency and to promote investments in South Sudan, of course, in these sectors. This one is what they call the mining cadastre. The mining cadastre is divided. Definitely, there are a lot of exploration licenses that are given to companies. I don't know how the process was done. This is something that the Ministry of Petroleum and the Ministry of Mining now should be really upfront. If they say really they want to fight corruption, because it's our individual right as citizens of South Sudan to know exactly who has got where, which cadastre, and why, which area in the cadastre, and why. How much has they paid? Nobody knows. But you can see Professor Bosiri, Kush Mining, Equator Gold, Spear Mining. There are very many of them in the cadastre.
Tell us a little bit about Professor Bosiri. Who is he?
And now I'm seeing in the cadastre, he has got a portion in the cadastre that, of course, is in one of the companies. I don't know the company of Bosiri and all this. I thought the Bosiri was a prophet.
That's Moses Simon Soro, former county commissioner of Morobo in Yei River State. In the second part of this interview, which airs on Monday, Soro will speak about why there's fighting in Yei River State. He spoke with me from London via WhatsApp last night. That's our show for this Friday. We now leave you with the song A Wedding Day by Isaka Number One.
It is a wedding day.
Wedding day.
Day is Tanina Tajunubin.
We are Morozede.
It is a wedding day.
Wedding day.
Day is Tanina Tajunubin.
We've been listening to Isaka Number One with the song It's a Wedding Day. If this weekend is your wedding day, we wish you all the best. I'm John Tanza in Washington. We appreciate you making us part of your evening. Have a safe weekend and join us again next week for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
In a wedding day,